Welcome once again to One Step Beyond, and it is time now for the main body of the prepared portion of tonight's program. And once again, we are going to be adding to Radio Free America program number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. We are going to be interviewing Wilhelm Stauffer, again a pseudonym for the head of Stauffer Consultants, also a pseudonym, a international consulting firm based primarily in Europe that advises foreign governments and multinational corporations, again mostly European governments, on political developments, and they have an explicitly anti-fascist perspective. And so let's sacrifice a Tootsie Roll at the altar of the gods of technology and hope that our phones are working this evening. So let's see if indeed they are. Good evening, Willy. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Good evening, Dave.
Alrighty. Well, welcome to the airwaves here. You're coming in loud and clear.
Thank you.
And before we get to the substance of the interview, I want to offer my personal gratitude to you and your colleagues for the tremendous work that you've done, because you've done the human race an enormous service. And I also want to thank you personally for the privilege of accessing some of your magnificent work. It is indeed a pleasure to, and this is not to polish the apple, but to work with individuals of the caliber of Stauffer Consultants.
Well, the work is there to be used, and any more hyperbole makes me nervous.
Okay, well, I know how you feel. Anyway, the first thing that I wanted to go into comes from one of your monographs, and it concerns the way that Germany, the now reunited and resurgent Germany, is utilizing a ploy to have German made the dominant language of the EC, the European Community, and how that is affecting their policy vis-a-vis Eastern Europe and the nations of the former Soviet Union. One of the most important aspects of that paper, I believe, is the significance of language and how it is going to affect development, political developments, and the understanding of the very term democracy in those nations. Could you begin there, please?
Well, first and foremost, in the paper that we were speaking of the role of language choices in the future Europe, because the European Commission now uses, of course, 11 or 12 major languages and some rather minor languages, except in their foreign involvements they use only English and French, and to include German as one of the major languages in their foreign policy and in the European Court of Justice would obviously help Germany in its developments in Eastern Europe, because the fact is that there is some legitimate argument for German to be one of the major languages of the European Community by virtue of the reunited Germany's total population being greater than that of either France or of the United Kingdom or of Italy. Beyond that, however, the figures are false, and the number of total German speakers throughout the European continent have been bandied about from one source to another, and through diligent research we were still unable to come up with a total number of German speakers. Helmut Kohl, the German Chancellor, seems to adopt his own figures of 114 million German-speaking people in Europe, and the other three sources we had, which were from Routledge Reference in London and from the Oxford University Press and from the Edinburgh Press, from Professor Dietrich Strauss of the University of Frankfurt, come up with considerably fewer German speakers. Now, where are these German speakers? Between 88 million people, maximum, that responsible linguists have found speaking German throughout all the European countries together, and the 114 million that the German government is now espousing as being German native speakers, are some 26 million people that we cannot account for. If there were to be a map, for example, of the United States without 26 million people, there would be most of California, I believe, missing.
One of the things that's interesting to me about the information in your paper is the way in which some of the German-speaking minorities in places like Poland, the Volksdeutsche, who figured prominently in Hitler's foreign policy and then were a major focus of activity of the XPLA ministry itself, in many ways a projection forward into history of the Third Reich, the way in which the Volksdeutsche in Poland and the Volga Germans are being utilized and the figures fudged, as you've indicated, in order to justify the inclusion of German as a major language. And indeed, as you point out in your paper, the language that the emerging democracies, hopefully emerging democracies in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, the language that they learn about democracy in will have much to do with the shaping of those nations.
Will. Part of this is because, if I may interrupt only briefly.
Sure.
Part of this is because German is a language which, although is very precise at certain levels, also contains a Hegelian aspect in which each word can contain four or five or more shifting definitions of terms depending on the emphasis the speaker wished to give it. So in that sense, the German language is nearly oriental in comparison to French, Italian, or English. The next thing is that German, in order to serve as a vehicle of control and hegemony of the growing fascism in Germany, must dominate over other competing second languages. If we take a look at the map of emerging Eastern Europe, Polish, Czech, Slovak, Hungarian, and three Baltic languages, we have seven languages, none of which has more than 20 to 24 million speakers, most of them far fewer native speakers. Therefore, for them to participate adequately and successfully at a competitive level in the village of global communications of today and tomorrow, they must be able to master one or more significant second languages of science and technology and commerce. Therefore, they will wind up learning either English or French or German, necessarily. The point here is that the German government is inventing figures to justify investments of large sums of money in educating Eastern Europe into learning German as their second language. Once they are involved in the German-dominated database, technologically, they are one step further along the road towards vassalage to the united, more powerful, growing German state.
By the way, I should emphasize that the discussion this evening should not be interpreted by listeners as being anti-German, but rather the focus of the work of Stauffer Consultants, as well as obviously yours truly, is anti-fascist, and it is...
It is anti-fascist. Germans are not all fascists. Not all fascists are Germans, and not all Germans are fascists. But fascism is the greatest single danger that Europe will face, both West and East, in the coming 10 years. And for this reason, it is of extreme urgency that we develop these points with objectivity and with empirical evidence in order to bring home to the population in both Europe and the United States the nature of the danger and what measures may be taken to combat it.
All right. Now, once again, the use as a foreign policy tool of the German-speaking minorities or alleged German-speaking minorities in places like Russia, the Volga Germans, the Volksdeutsche in Poland, that was used by Adolf Hitler as a justification for his push to the East.
Heim ins Reich. Come home to the Reich, yes.
Right. And the Drang nach Osten, I'm not sure how that's pronounced.
You are correct. Drang nach Osten. Right now, if we take what the Auswärtiges Amt, that is the German Foreign Ministry, what they spend in Poland alone is $25 million per year to encourage German ethnicity in Polish Silesia. The German name for Silesia is Schlesien, which results in some anomalies. For example, there are now German language street signs in Polish villages where none existed throughout history. And this has been done without the permission of the local Polish government.
Remarkable. Remarkable.
Incidentally, wherever you would like, I will cite the reference or the source of some of these. Normally, our statistics have three or four or more sources, but I can usually cite a convenient one for your listeners so that they can look it up and duplicate the research.
Please do, Vili, wherever you can, cite sources, because as you know from listening to my work, that is one of the things that I try to make a point of doing. And also, where possible, if you could spell some of the German words, because with your various degrees, you're conversant with many of these terms that will, of course, be new to many of our listeners.
We shall. It will, however, be your duty to point out to me where this would be of help to them.
Okay.
Otherwise, I'm boring enough without doing that already.
All righty. Well, you sell yourself short. If I engage in hyperbole, you are being falsely modest. But anyway,
the last figures I gave you are from the combination of the Statistisches Jahrbuch, or the Statistical Yearbook of Germany, in which it is official that they spend over $25 million a year. supporting the so-called Silesian Germans in present-day Poland. And the second articles concerning the street signs that had never been in German before in all the history of Poland, in that portion of Poland, was from Der Spiegel, S-P-I-E-G-E-L, Der Spiegel of November 30, 1992. That is a prominent German news weekly, similar to Time or Newsweek. And incidentally, Polish researchers with whom we spoke at the Demographic Institute in Poznan, Poland, their director is named Andrzej Saxon, and they determined that there are approximately 8,000, perhaps 10,000 maximum, ethnic German speakers still residing in Poland, and they placed this at the disposal of researchers in their yearbook and magazine of Nowy Dziennik, January 92. Now, in addition, the U.S. ambassador to Poland, the Honorable John R. Davis, Jr., stated that the Silesian German situation is very similar. He feels that there are very few German-speaking people left in Poland, nearly none, and that the so-called German minority is a group of Silesians in Opolia, Silesia near Krakow and Katowice, which is not former German territory. This was never German territory. There had been a Polish minority, a German-speaking minority. It is many fewer today. But there were always people who wanted to be Polish. If they wanted to be Polish, they said they were. If they wanted to be German, they said they were German. And he made a large speech and a paper in a book called Poland in a World of Change, published by the University Press of America last year, 1992. So our point is that there is nothing wrong with sending aid to Poland. There should be more done of this and not less. However, when it is used to divide one ethnic group in a neighboring country against another ethnic group, in an age in which, in the crumbling of communism and in the resurgence of nationalism and of ethnocentrism, which is one of the greatest dangers we have and which usually goes hand in hand with fascism, although not always, then at least we have the duty to recognize this and, in combating it, to encourage every government to send aid to an entire country to help their economic and political stability and democratic freedoms, and not simply to organize the support of an ethnic minority group within those borders, because that is nothing more nor less than intermeddling in other people's private internal affairs, which the Germans are always the first to object to if someone interferes in their affairs, such as we are doing at this minute.
Now, it's interesting, Billy. One of the examples you cite in one of your papers is the selectivity of aid, German aid, being given to Poland, and whereas Polish anti-fascist resistance fighters had requested that aid be given to develop cancer treatment centers in Poland, the German government said they did
and
not...
That is unfortunately correct. The Polish government had authorized a number of Polish citizens and prominent citizens to approach the Germans to ask desperately and urgently for children's cancer centers to be set up in Poland. The reason for this was, unfortunately, there is a high rate of leukemia due to the environmental disasters that the communist regimes in East Germany and in Poland had done over the years. So there is a need for cancer research. There is a need which cries out to entire humanity to patch up not only the environment but also the people who suffer from it throughout Eastern Europe. And as a result, Mr. Mark Edelman, who was the only surviving leader of the 1943 Warsaw Ghetto uprising against the Nazis, and he said, and I quote from him, if I may, it's a short quote.
Sure.
A few months ago, I asked Chancellor Kohl for his help on behalf of the Solidarity Health Foundation in its fight against cancer in Poland. The Chancellor responded that his budget was so tight that he could not help us. As we could see a few months later, much greater sums could be found to help other people when, I am sorry to say, German interests were at stake. This was from a book called When the Wall Came Down, published by Routledge Publishers, 1992, on page 329. The problem there is not unique. The point is that German money has been there to support German interests in other countries, and according to Professor Misha Glenny, at the University of Paris, that this is typical of modern German governmental thinking, is that they are not the least concerned with other minority groups. They are concerned with minority rights and civil rights and human liberties only when they concern German ethnic minorities beyond their borders, behind someone else's borders. Then they are obsessively preoccupied with the German ethnicity of whoever those people are.
Okay, having taken care of our FCC business, now, with regard to German activism in the countries of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, two of the very important points that you made in your papers. And by the way, before I get to this, I should perhaps reiterate for the benefit of the listening audience a couple of the major points in Radio Free America 37. Those were the roles of the Vertriebenen groups and the Expelle ministry in the quote new unquote Germany in perpetuating the same sort of Ostpolitik that Adolf Hitler had pursued, except the expansion here is not being done through force of arms, at least not yet, but rather through politics. And indeed, von Clausewitz had a very famous phrase that war is the continuation of politics by other means. And one of the major points that I made in Radio Free America 37 is that the post-World War II Reich has turned that around, and they are using politics as a continuation of war by other means. And again, I refer people to Radio Free America number 37, and specifically installment 11 of that massive program. Now, two of the fascinating and very important aspects of your monographs, Vili, concern the way in which Germany has actually been promoting ethnic friction. Obviously, there's a great deal of trauma now going on in places like the former Yugoslavia. There are civil wars going on in many states of the former Soviet Union. And you make the point that far from acting as a peacekeeper and a mollifying agent, that Germany has actually been exacerbating many of these tensions. Can you go into that, please?
I think that probably you have even expressed it better than we did. And I think that is basically exactly what we were saying. If I could give a couple of examples beyond the idea of their supporting German minority ethnic groups in other countries, whether it is Romania. Germany recently lodged enormous serious protests with the foreign ministry of the country of Romania, which has struggles enough on its hands now, as we all know, that they are afraid that civil liberties for German-speaking minorities, there are two groups of German speakers in Romania, one is the Schwaben, Donau Schwaben, and the other is the Siebenbürger Sachsen, who have been there by choice for some hundreds of years, speaking their two separate dialects of an older form of German, and that they were afraid that these people are being disadvantaged. There are a total of 100,000 German speakers in Romania. However, the Germans omitted any mention whatsoever of gypsies. The Germans are now sending back a quarter of a million gypsies out of Germany back to Romania, saying they do not qualify for asylum. Those gypsies were pogromed out of Romania to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Now they are being sent back to certain persecution, and the Germans have no interest in the gypsies whatever. They would like to get rid of them, just as they did in World War II. Except now they are paying the Romanian government to take a quarter of a million of them back out of German territory, and their main concern is not with their civil rights. They don't care where they go. Many of these gypsies were born in Germany and speak very little Sinti or Rom. They speak primarily German. And the Germans are concerned primarily with the interest of the German-speaking minority in Romania to the exclusion of any other group. In Hungary, it was similar. The New Democratic Forum, which obtained a majority in the elections and now runs the government in Hungary, has turned to the right and has turned anti-Semitic, and as a result is being rewarded by investments of sums of money from large German corporations. And one of the other results outside of the blatant anti-Semitism that has come to the forefront in Budapest is also the curtailment of civil liberties and freedom of expression. Dagens Nyheter, a respected Swedish daily paper, wanted to bring a great infusion of cash into a struggling Hungarian daily paper, and the government forbade them to do so, saying that they would wait instead for German money because it had more in common with the government ideology.
And now, one of the points that I made in Radio Free America, actually both 36 and 37, the former being a program, a massive archive show also that I did on the destabilization of the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe, the New Democratic Forum in Hungary has become to a considerable extent a repository for the residual elements of the Arrow Cross organization, which was the fascist organization of Hungary, which along with Romania and Bulgaria were wartime allies of the Third Reich.
Now that you mention that is much more belonging to the tree than to the current fruit of the fascistic Orange Tree. But as I was saying, if we also have that information, and there is a good article in fact, one of the last good objective articles in Hungary's paper, Magyar Nemzet, which appeared in, I have a date of 27 October 1991. They were saying the same thing as you are, and then after that, the funding stopped, and they were suppressed, and so in a, with velvet gloves. But so they're having trouble with that. There is, in every such country, there is such an example. In Slovakia just now, the new government in Bratislava, after the separation of the Czech Republic from the Slovak Republic, Metzger's government also is decidedly anti-Semitic and is starting to crush civil dissidents and freedom of expression and speech in a manner which is looked upon very favorably by Helmut Kohl and by his historians and by his advisors.
It should be mentioned that during World War II, when Czechoslovakia was, of course, occupied by Nazi Germany, Slovakia was set up as an independent fascist puppet state under the Reverend Josef Tiso and the collaborationist Linke Party, elements of which then jumped not only to U.S. intelligence through the Galen Organization, about which we'll say more later, but they became the World Slovak Congress became a repository for many of those elements, and they became a key element of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, an element of the former World Anti-Communist League. The neo-fascist character, and perhaps neo is wrong here, but the neo-fascist character of the newly independent Slovakia has not been reported upon in the American press, as indeed most of the revelations that are contained in your monographs coming from the European press, well, they have been omitted in the American media.
This is something that we probably should go into more detail about a little later. Mm-hmm. I would prefer that we try to stack this with as many empirical evidences as possible.
Right.
And at the moment, and then we can go around in circle and try to discuss the ideology which led to this and why do we have such a situation? Because we are seeing a stunning increase of disinformation both in the European and in the American press.
Alrighty. Now, one of the things that is interesting to me too, coming from your white papers, Well, we could also talk about German support for independent Croatia, and there is much attention focused by the world on the crisis in the former Yugoslavia, and at least in the American media, the Serbs are being taken to task as the arch-villains of the whole situation. It is certainly indeed a deep tragedy all the way around, but one group that has largely escaped criticism in the United States is the government of Croatia, and the Franjo Tudjman, and I'm not sure how that's pronounced, the correct pronunciation, has denied that the Holocaust happened, has endorsed ethnic cleansing, and to a considerable extent, the government there appears to be a reactivation, a return to power, if you will, of the old Ustashi, the fascist collaborationist government of independent Croatia under, independent in quotes, under Adolf Hitler. And indeed, Germany has shown not only a lot of political support for Croatian independence and the Croatian secession from Yugoslavia in many ways triggered the debacle there, but they also have trained Croatian military people. Is that correct?
Yes, they have, and there is good hard evidence that German mercenaries were training them the entire time. There's nothing new about this any more than there is anything new about neo-fascism. Also, this matter of denial of the Holocaust and then denial of Auschwitz, the Auschwitz-Lüge, this is an Eintrittskarte. This is a ticket of admission to the fascist inner circles. If you are a struggling prime minister or a foreign minister of a country which has definite problems with independence and with free market economies, all you need to do is lift your megaphone in the direction of Bonn and Berlin, and you say, there was never a Holocaust, and Auschwitz was a lie. And then the truckloads of cargo and money will soon start dropping in your direction.
Well, it's interesting because one is hearing quite a bit of that now in the United States from certain circles like the Liberty Lobby.
This is the result of that virus having been started in the what they call the Wende, which in Germany we had in the 80s, that the historians in the historical Streit were arguing about the existence of fault, of collective guilt and of individual guilt, as to the whose fault was Auschwitz, whose fault was the Holocaust, did it actually exist, or were Germans merely placed in a position of necessity by conniving nations scheming all around them? This is something which occurs by degrees. The burning fire is always there. Sometimes social democrats or liberals will turn down the fire a bit, and then the right wing or Christian democrats combined with the far right will then turn the fire up again. But the same kettle has always been boiling, containing the same ingredients. If I could give you another example of what they are doing in Eastern Europe, you know that the Germans, and we are going to discuss this later, I hope, if you have the time, that the Germans are trying to change, to amend their Grundgesetz, their basic constitution, to amend it in three ways, and one of these is to be able to run out refugees. They claim they have too many refugees. This is the cause for all the riots, all the fire, all the firebombing, and all the murders over 20 last year. And that the reason for their changing the constitution to do this is so that they will have their refugee laws and their asylum laws in line with the rest of Europe. How they intend to enforce this is by getting a cordon sanitaire, or a ring of countries around them, to enforce German law for them, so that the refugees will never even make it to the German border. This reminds me of Dachau. The citizens of Dachau never saw the prisoners coming to the concentration camp there in World War II, because the prisoners were routed a different way, because the villagers had complained, "We don't want to take the responsibility for having seen hundreds of thousands of Jews coming through our village."
It's interesting.
So now the Germans are coming to the same way. If they don't have any knowledge, then they can deny individual responsibility for the fate of the half a million or so refugees who otherwise would come in this year. Therefore, Germans have changed their laws to say that if the nation across which the refugees travel in transit on their way to Germany, if those countries themselves are stable democracies, then they should have applied for asylum there instead of coming to Germany.
It's fascinating to hear that sort of a terrible echo of the past, indeed so much of this.
It is a terrible echo. In fact, I'm happy you used those words, because that is exactly what the foreign ministers of the Czech Republic, of Austria, and of Poland all said about it. They do not like the idea. Prime Minister Sikorska of Poland traveled to Vienna especially for the purpose of helping to call a meeting of Central and Eastern European prime ministers and foreign ministers to say, are we going to take this from Greater Germany? Must we be? Now, not only do we have the option removed from us of having our own refugees and asylum laws, our own immigration laws. No, now we even have to enforce Germany's laws, and we didn't even pass these in our own parliaments. This is done without our consultation and against our will. Once again, we are being bullied, not by hobnailed boots, but by economic blackmail.
Fascinating.
These words that I just told you is from an article from the Süddeutsche Zeitung, which is a respected large German daily appearing in Munich, and that was from the 28th of February.
Alrighty, of 1993.
Of 1993, that's right.
Alrighty, one of the things that's interesting, your observations about the way in which the citizens of Dachau did not want to see what they all knew was going on, one of the points that I've made over the years is, and once again, I want to reiterate that this discussion should not be interpreted as being anti-German, but rather it's anti-fascist, and as Willy noted, not all Germans are fascists, and not all fascists are Germans, but the danger of fascism is essentially a two-pronged assault. There are the Nazis, the N-A-Z-I-S, and the Nazis, the N-O-T-S-E-E-S, and the former depend on the latter for their success to a large extent. One of the things that has been noted by, among others, Günter Grass, the novelist, the celebrated novelist in Germany, is that the German government, the people wearing the white collars, are pursuing policies that are identical with those advocated not only by Adolf Hitler, but by the so-called skinheads. In this country, we're being told that the violence there is simply the work of skinheads, a rabble, and that it's not a serious phenomenon, and we don't have to worry about it. It would appear that Günter Grass's observations are absolutely on the money.
Not only Günter Grass, but several others have recently said, many times Germans will say these things outside their own country, and they fear reprisals if they speak too freely within their own country. Even a little social ostracism sometimes does the job. Remember that there is no real word for in our German language for standing up to authority. We borrowed a term from the French called civil courage, and let that go. But remember, there is no native German concept here. It is missing from their educational and social system. So we have to be a bit careful. We are partially criticizing a century and a half of German sensitivities, of being overbearing, and of German will to power, and their lust for expansion. And yet, at the same time, we are constrained scientifically to examine the causes within German society. Why did they have to expand? Why do they still have this Dark nach Osten that is still even at issue at all? Other nations, democratic nations, when they come into economic troubled times, such as the United States in a recession and unemployment, they go to the world and say, please excuse me, friends and neighbors, I must bow out for a little bit and contemplate my own navel until I have cleared up this infection. That Germany seems to be doing just the opposite. They are falling into a system of two-speed or two-tier Germany, and the troubles that are caused by the insufficiencies and the disappointments and the failures of the internal system, they are expanding outward to compensate. They are projecting their failures onto Europe. And this is the part that is extremely difficult now.
I want to get into the discussion of the two-tiered society, and indeed you were talking to me when we spoke off the air about a Professor Dieter Brock and a fantastic article that he had in the Süddeutsche, fantastic not meaning incredible, but remarkable. And we'll get into that later on in this evening discussion. By the way, Willy, we have until 11 o'clock this evening, so we can stretch out on many of these points. With regard to jumping back a minute to German aid...
I do not envy your telephone bill, you know that.
But it's worth it. We have to make the investment, I think, because it's just one of those things. You can't win them all. The German aid to Eastern Europe, the figures, according to the research done by you and your associates, has been fudged. The Germans are actually handing out disinformation with regard to the amount of aid that they have given to Eastern Europe. Can you go into that?
They have unfortunately done that. I do not have as many figures at my fingertips right now as I would like. One of the things I meant to say was that, and I'm looking for some of them at the moment, one of the problems with German aid is that we must distinguish, on the one hand, between aid that is actually going into businesses, that is going into reconstruction and economic development on the one hand, and what is actually propagandistic on the other. For example, in all of their statistics, the German government cites enormous amounts of money given to the Goethe Institute, that is G-O-E-T-H-E, Goethe Institute. Many Americans know that Goethe was to our German literature what Shakespeare was to the English. And there is nothing wrong with having a cultural and literary organization which is paid by taxpayers' money to acquaint people with the better side of our nature, with the brighter, sunshinier side of our soul in other countries. The United States has its U.S. Information Agency, and in Germany they have such a thing that they call the America House, where cultural symposiums and seminars and papers are presented and films are seen and free discussion about culture. And this is what Goethe Institute had started out doing, and in some place during the mid-80s, about the same time as the country turned right, radically right, which it is now still turning, then the Goethe Institute became confounded somewhat with the intelligence gathering, the HUMINT, or human intelligence gathering functions of the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the BND, which is, you know, as you have explained to your listeners, is the successor organization to Galen's original brainchild, and is the German version of the CIA.
Right, and has basically represented a projection forward through the decades since World War II of the actual German General Staff and Intelligence Service. You and your colleagues...
Could I give you some example of figures now?
Oh, absolutely. Sure, please.
Actually, in 1992, for example, in Eastern Europe, the United States in private business investment was over $8 billion. in private business investment into Eastern Europe,
mm-hmm.
which was more than double the German investment. Germany is right there, and Germany is claiming to be the biggest investor and biggest help in Entwicklungshilfe, or development aid. And they themselves only invested $2.5 billion. This figure is probably the cleanest figure we can get, because it excludes the monies that Western Germany placed into their own new Eastern German states. So that only includes aid that they sent to Poland, to the Czech Republic, to the Slovak Republic, to Hungary, etc. Of at least equal importance is the fact that real German investment figures drop dramatically when the government-sponsored propaganda and intelligence gathering programs are subtracted. The total annual cost of the Goethe Institute are some 300 million marks, which is around $200 million. The total annual cost, and the Deutsche Welle radio and television, which is pure propaganda, 360 million marks per year. Deutschlandfunk, the same, is $180 million per year. The Bundesnachrichtendienst, no one knows, because they do not publish figures on how much money they are appropriated, but it has to be somewhat more than $1.5 billion, not D-marks, but dollars, $1.5 billion annually for its work in surveillance in Eastern Europe. Now, this may not seem like a lot, but when you consider that the Germans should, if they want to show how good our citizenship is and how much we have regard for other democracies, we should be cutting down this figure and not jacking it up. Actually, however, the BND is not obliged to reduce its staff or its expenditures by more than perhaps 10% by 1996.
This is
10% reduction by 1997. In Eastern Europe, they have over 15,000 agents and part-time agents and informers and tattlers and so forth, the entire retinue that an intelligence organization carries with it. And all these figures, for the most part, are from the Statistisches Jahrbuch, which is the official German statistical annual for 1992.
Oh, okay. However,
we cannot tell how much money the BND actually gets for its spying services, because it doesn't go through the Bundestag or the German Parliament. It bypasses Parliament entirely and is answerable only to the Chancellor.
I'm glad you cited the source. I was going to ask for that. Now, with regard to the Goethe Institute and the BND...
Well, the source of the American money and the German money, and also Austria and Italy invest more in Eastern Europe than Germany does, and that is from World Trade Magazine in December 1992.
All right. I appreciate
that. And also the Dynamics of European Integration.
Right.
The two main sources for that, as well as such things as Business Week magazine of January 18th, 1993, also has some articles that are of interest in that.
Okay. With regard to the Goethe Institute, and we're going to get to the BND later on in the discussion, the Goethe Institute is, as you've indicated and as you've developed in your papers, very much involved with the BND. It has the reputation of being a nice humanitarian and cultural organization, yet in fact it is very closely linked with the BND, the German intelligence service, and the successor to Hitler's organization, the Gehlen Group. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, Willy, and also one of the interesting things in your papers is how some 500 Goethe Institute libraries have been uprooted and are being relocated to Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union.
I think not so many. I think that would be even more dramatic than it is, but my latest figures, I believe, are 130.
Oh, not 500. Okay.
No, this is according to the Goethe Institute itself, and whenever you telephone, as I do, to the Goethe Institute in München, in Munich, from time to time, to ask them figures, they have to say, well, who needs to know? And mm-hmm. They are not very public. They are public in saying that the Germans will cultivate the mythology of a superior culture, even if it must consider a lot of Austrians and Swiss and Czechs as being honorary Germans for the purposes of propaganda, such as Sigmund Freud, such as Franz Kafka, and Grillparzer, but otherwise, they are non-entities if they are not German. And the Goethe Institute has been extremely chauvinistic over the years in this regard, and is getting worse at it. The point here is that the direct involvement of the BND as an espionage group in its participation has to be measured by outside sources. It's very difficult to invade the center of a very good and expert espionage group such as the BND. I believe you have mentioned on more than one occasion that the retiring chief of the KGB, of the KGB, had also said that his hat was off and gave many kudos to, in his many years of experience, to the BND for its expertise and its professional conduct of espionage.
In fact, and that was in the second installment of the aforementioned Radio Free America 37. So then it's 130 some odd, or 110, it's not 500.
They are closing, at this moment, they have already closed 100, or in the process of closing 130 libraries in Western Europe, such places as Brussels, Antwerp, Liverpool, Birmingham, Dublin, etc., and moving them east into Eastern Europe to start the great cultural campaign, the Kulturkampf, a cultural struggle against the evil forces of the English language, presumably, for want of a better expression, and taking a lot of personnel and uprooting them and sending them east in order to teach German and to teach German ways and German culture, whatever that is, to the troops there in Eastern Europe. And they are changing their libraries accordingly. They have come unstuck on a couple of occasions. They opened a Goethe Institute in Prague, Czechoslovakia, not long ago, and the local population had noticed that it took them forever to renovate the building. And the trouble was that it had previously been the East German embassy, and so that they had to take away all the cultural work that the Germans had done before under a communist banner, and now they take that away and they substitute new German cultural business and try to tell the people of Czech Republic in Prague that that one German culture was wrong and the other one was right. So they're doing it all out of the same building, but presumably they have removed all the bugs and electronic eavesdropping devices and replaced them with state-of-the-art equipment.
All right, and again, to reiterate, the BND and the Goethe Institute are very close, and there is significant BND involvement.
Well, they have something in common. They don't have to justify their actions to the parliament.
We're going to go into specifically the lack of accountability of the BND later on in the program, but yes, just for in passing, we should mention that the BND, unlike the CIA, which has at least a small degree of accountability to Congress, the BND has none whatsoever to the Bundestag, correct?
If they ever did have any, they do not any longer, and they have even less than before. Some of the things that we have to say about the Bundesnachrichtendienst, they are not under constraint as the CIA is in theory about keeping their operations offshore. The BND spies on its own citizens just as willingly and gleefully as it spies on foreigners.
That also is true of the CIA, but there isn't even nominal control in Germany.
No, there is not. There used to be theoretically a distinction that the Bundesverfassungsschutz would take through the Ministry of the Interior would control subversives within the country, and the BND would control them from without the country. However, the BND found it necessary to spy inside the country because the presence of so many foreigners running through old Germany, including American troops, made it necessary to have a good, both civilian and military, human intelligence gathering source right there on the spot. Much of it was compromised by mixtures with Stasi, the East German intelligence gathering outfits, and much of it is compromised yet today, which is one of the reasons why you do not see such enlightening debates in Parliament and the Bundestag as there should be, because people are a little bit afraid, I think, that none of them have a clean vest entirely, none of the members that otherwise would be taking firm, strong stands on future programs, and they're afraid of doing so for fear that any opponent might be tempted to delve a little bit more diligently into the other person's past.
But again, the relationship between BND and the Goethe Institute, the relocation of Goethe Institute libraries to Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, should be seen against the background of what we've already discussed, the, for lack of a better term, linguistic imperialism that Germany is engaging in vis-a-vis the EC, Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union, and their citing of the Volksdeutsche, the Volga Germans, and other groups that had long been the focus of activism by the Vertriebenen groups. The Goethe Institute...
They regard all those groups as outposts of German civilization, which will at the right time join hands.
Right, and that is eerily reminiscent, of course, of Adolf Hitler, and consistent with the policies of the Vertriebenen groups, the XLA ministry, the Witego League, and other things that we talked about in Radio Free America 37. Now, another of the very important points in your monographs, Vili, concerns the some steps taken by Germany beyond promoting ethnic friction in places like the former Yugoslavia and Slovakia. They have actively moved to, or elements of the German government have actively moved to frustrate civil liberties and human rights provisions in the constitution of the EC.
Yeah.